Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Soft Revolution, the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Torquil Campbell.
I'm Ali Moman.
And this week on the pod, we got a good one, folks. We have Carl Newman, an amazing songwriter. You may know him from the band The New Pornographers, which he founded way back in the day with Dan Behar and a bunch of other brilliant people, Nico Case. He is also an incredible songwriter in his own right. He's made a bunch of beautiful solo records, which if you haven't heard, you should go check out. And Carl is a Canadian. He's from Vancouver, but he has the unique experience of having lived in the United States for the last 10 years and has been raising a kid there and trying to make his life there. He loves it there. And I wanted to talk to Carl about what it's like, first of all, to be an expat right now, a Canadian living in America as we approach this biggest of all days, the federal election in the United States, but also about what it's like to be an artist in the time of Trump and why the hell he hasn't gotten on a bus north. So all that coming up with my friend Carl Newman. Please stick around for that. It's going to be a great chat. But first, the news of the week. Ali Moman, your thoughts on life. Please say something hopeful. That's what I come to you for. You know, folks, we don't get paid for this. My payment is having Ali say something that makes me not jump off my balcony for another 6 days.
Well,
so
no
pressure, Ali.
But well, I don't know if you're going to find this hopeful. I don't know if you're going to find this hopeful, but I've been thinking lately about what is the biggest problem facing us as a society right now. It is a problem that sits underneath everything. And if we do not fix this, we are not going to get anything major done. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is social media. It is social media. So I want to tell you where this started for me, where I said, okay, a couple days ago, I was on the Facebook. I saw from somebody whom I care about, somebody who I love, somebody who's a good person, saying some fucked up shit. And it was stupid. It literally was a post saying, I find it really interesting, don't you think? You know, that a PCR test is 40 years old, yet they're inputting a new virus into this 40-year-old test? Also, I find it also interesting that, you know, 71% of people who wear masks, according to this CDC study, they all got COVID. And yet we're all wearing masks and cases are going up. Now I sit there and I'm just like, my little basic critical thinking knob just goes from 0 to 1 and it says, okay, wait, the PCR test is merely something you put the swab into, right? It's like saying, why is my MacBook Pro from 2019 accepting software from 2020?
Why does this car still take oil?
Yeah.
What it was fuck? It was made last year. Why isn't it powered by water?
Yeah. What the fuck?
Interesting.
And then, so anyways, I was, you know, kind to them. I said, look, you know, please do not get your information from memes. Do not get your information from Facebook. Let me send you an Associated Press and a Washington Post fact check.
You wrote to them on Facebook.
Yeah. I said, you know, let me send you this thing, you know, that actually that study. And, you know, Trump actually quoted it too with Savannah Guthrie on that town hall where he said, I just read, you know, 87% of people who had masks got COVID. Basically, what that CDC study was that they took a swath of people who had COVID-19. One of the things in the sample study in the group was that 87% of them wore masks regularly. However, all of them went to a restaurant and a bar where they took the mask off. So it wasn't so much about whether or not masks give you COVID or not. It was where these individuals got COVID. And the conclusion of that study was actually that restaurants and bars where you have to take your mask off are inherently not the safest place. But of course, what happened was conservatives
don't have to take your mask off at a theater. Just want to note that everybody out there.
Yeah,
continue
just like,
to make
ding,
that point. Nobody gives
ding
a shit,
that in.
But gonna keep on saying it.
I know that's so true. That is very true. But what ended up happening was, you know, the right wing, the conservatives, the content mills, they literally took that the fact of 87% of people wearing masks got COVID, and that's what got pushed through the stratosphere, through the internet. And I'm sitting here and I'm looking at this and she's showing me, she's like, look, Ali, she showed me her screenshots. She goes, look, Ali, when I search for COVID CDC masks, what I see on my Google is this. Look, they're hiding information from me. When I do the search myself, look at what I find. And on her Google search, what I saw was like not reputable, accredited news. It wasn't like when I search that, I see fact checks about that thing. She was showing me websites from not Detroit Free Press, but beyond the DetroitPress.org, not the LA Times, but the CaliforniaGlobe.net with these fake bullshit things.
Because
that
the algorithm of Google was pushing it for her. Gives you what you've already eaten.
Yes. And
that's
it knows that
it
she's
does.
Going down the spiral. So I started to go to myself. I said, wait, look, I could step back and say this individual, and we have people like this, you know, QAnon is growing and all these conspiracies are growing. And we could say that these people are inherently stupid. Yes, sir. Yeah, we can say that. But I don't think so. We talk about systemic racism. I think we need to talk about systemic stupidity. That what is happening right now is that people are not set up for success. And if we do not fix social media, we are going to tear at the seams, and we need deep and profound legislation and regulation. And you ask, why are we regulating these things? We regulate when a company or a product or a thing becomes a utility. Just take telecom, TELUS, Bell, Rogers, AT&T, whatever you want to talk about. We have to regulate these companies because they become ubiquitous. They become necessary in order to exist. I want everyone to ask themselves, can you exist without social media? The answer is absolutely not. Not if you want to thrive, not if you want to connect into society. You can go be a hermit, sure, but it's not going to work. Therefore, we need to do some sensible fucking things to stop the spread of stupidity. It is like yelling fire in a theater. I'm not allowed to do it in a theater. Why should people be allowed to do it online? And there
are
some...
You know what's extraordinary is that to this day, you still can't say the word fuck on network television in the United States, such as the control imposed by the FCC.
And the CRTC, yeah. Yeah. So we have to start treating these things as media companies.
Why was there this bill of goods sold that these things were not media companies and simply platforms for open ideas, along with the idea of algorithm? I mean, either somebody was a great con man and sold this stuff to politicians in such a way that they didn't notice that inherent contradiction, or politicians are so second rate and lazy and venal and greedy that they didn't care.
Politicians don't understand, Torque. They don't understand. Case in point, Doug Ford, our premier, he comes up every single day and he is telling these Silicon Valley companies, the Uber Eats, the DoorDash, to hike down their prices because they charge 30% to restaurants, $4.99 to us. Here's the thing that he doesn't understand. These companies do not make money on that 30%. They are not making a profit. They come from the Silicon Valley model of business in which it's grow first, destroy the competition, and then hike up your prices and worry about monetization later. He doesn't understand this. So rather than going up there, chastising, shaming these people, he needs to be focused on legislation that subsidizes these costs. But it makes you think that anybody who runs for public office, if you do not know the difference between HTML and JavaScript, get the fuck out. This is where we are right now. People who are politicians need to understand how this technology works. Because if you do not fix this, you will not solve climate change. If we ever get into another pandemic like this, do you think we are going to have the public will and the institutions to get us through? If there's fucking fake news and disinformation being spread everywhere. What do you think, Torque? Absolutely not.
No, I mean, I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. And I want to go back to something you said earlier, which is that you can leave social media. It's not legally enforced. It's definitely socially enforced, but it's not legally enforced to be on social media. But as you say, if you want to make a living, if you want to have any interpersonal connections, if you want to know what's happening in the world, if you want to be able to have a side hustle or sell what you make, you have to be on social media. I'm on social media because the only way I'm making any money right now.
And you try to leave. I
constantly try to leave, but it is economically impossible for me to leave. So the revolution will not be televised. I continue to believe that. But at the moment, the only way to foment the revolution is through this medium that it defeats it even as we express the revolutionary thoughts. We express them on platforms that counteract and exist to deny and to crush those things, revolutionary thoughts that we are having. So this contradiction, can it be regulated into some kind of useful thing?
Yes.
In the same way that the free press can? I'm not as confident as you.
Yes.
I think that there has to be maybe a post social media world, which is, I think, a smaller, more difficult, less dynamic world. But I don't know if there is a positive outcome right now for the internet. You know, when the internet began, I was kicked out of grade 7 computer class because I went into computer class on the first day and they told us to write an essay about what we thought computers would be in the future. And I just wrote, "The computer is the worst invention since the nuclear bomb," over and over and over again, like Jack Nicholson in The Shining. And then I turned it in and they booted me out. And I think I was a smart kid. And I maintain that computers and the internet were the beginning of a precipitous fall for our brains and souls and for culture. They're fucking evil things. But let's not even start with that because we have a podcast to do.
Well, listen, there's some positive, and there are actually things that people, really smart people, things that I've even thought about. I'm not one of the smart ones, but things that I've thought about that we can do. For instance, there is no competition right now. You know, Facebook controls Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram. What we need to do is we need to do what we did to the telecom industry. Remember back in the day, when you had a phone number and you couldn't like go to another cell provider, someone has a better plan, but you couldn't go because you're like, fuck my number. I can't take my number with me. And it was like this thing. But then they created something called local number portability. You know, there's a big movement towards local data portability. All this shit that I give to Facebook, my photos, my messages, everything that they have used to just push ads for things having to do with labradoodles. You know, fine, you've made your money on me. But now if a competing social media service provider wants to come, I should be able to take my data, which is mine. I should be able to take it. The other thing is that, look, they say that they cannot algorithmically stop the spread of misinformation. I find that fucking ridiculous because they can track my face and know exactly who I am and where I am all across the internet, but yet they can't stop bullshit. What they can do, though, is they can have historical ratings and labels on sources. So based on historical fact checks, the New York Times, for instance, receives like an 80, whereas let's say the Detroit Beyond the Press.org probably gets a 10. So that when you're somebody who's going through the internet, you see that, hey, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't trust that stupid fucking website. And the final thing that we can do is we actually can find these companies. I know I bring up Germany so much, but they actually do that in Germany, because let's not forget what happened with misinformation, disinformation in Germany. In Germany, they understand the power and potency of this. And they literally charge Facebook 60 million euros if they do not take down hate speech and misinformation in a timely manner. America, we're thinking a lot about America. America has the First Amendment, and that's really interesting. But, you know, we don't have the First Amendment in Canada. Germany doesn't have it. So we could do something like that here. You know, America's really funny. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, before she passed, she did say that, it's funny, so Amy Coney Barrett is now the Supreme Court Justice, and she's an absolutist, like she's an originalist. She thinks that this piece of paper came down from the gods, the Constitution. But RBG, before she died, said, like, you know, the Canadian Constitution is better than ours. That if the founders were alive today, they would not make this thing. So there are things that we can do, Torque. I cannot say there isn't. Otherwise, we're fucked.
I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying. And I guess I would, to close this out, I would point out that once again, you know, you have this rating system, who does the ratings? The nature of capitalism is that someone lies at some point to create that capital. Someone convinces someone else that this particular thing is worth more than it actually is worth. And there will always be at the heart of any system that, of any platform that relies on capitalism, a lie. And that lie can be exploited by anyone who chooses to exploit it. Donald Trump understands that. Mark Zuckerberg understands that. Elon Musk understands that. Bill Gates understands that. And Jeff Bezos understands that. They exploit the lie that what you're paying for is worth what you're getting. And they exploit the lie that there is some kind of objective truth that only they hold on to. So I don't know. We started out by saying that, you know, I was coming to you for optimism, and I think you're ultimately right that there has to be an attempt at least to control these, you know, I think at this point the word evil is applicable to things like Facebook and Twitter and Snapchat and these things. But how much can you control something which is inherently broken in its first principles and maintains as its core a lie? So to this, you wanted to talk about one of the perfect examples of what I'm talking about, which is a meme that has started to take hold of the internet this week, which comes from a tweet that Kim Kardashian composed. Is that the word? Anyway,
brother, let me do a dramatic reading of this.
Yeah.
Can I
here,
please?
Here now, Ali Momin, star of Come From Away and many major motion pictures, reading Kim Kardashian's latest tweet. Ali?
Now, should I do it in her vocal fry or should I? No, I'll do a dramatic.
I think you should do it as if you're saying it, you know, at the funeral of your closest friend.
Okay. Okay, great. All right. Here we go. Here we go. 40 and feeling so humbled and blessed. There is not a single day that I take for granted, especially during these times when we are all reminded of the things that truly matter. For my birthday this year, I couldn't think of a better way to spend it than with some of the people who have helped shape me into the woman I am today.
Yeah.
Before COVID, I don't think any of us truly appreciated what a simple luxury it was to be able to travel and to be together with family and friends in a safe environment.
So true.
After 2 weeks of multiple health screens and asking everyone to quarantine, I surprised my closest inner circle with a trip to a private island where we could pretend things were normal just for a brief moment in time. We danced, rode bikes, swam near whales, kayaked, watched a movie on the beach, and so much more. I realized that for most people, this is something that is so far out of reach right now. So in moments like these, I am humbly reminded of how privileged my life is. Hashtag, this is 40.
The humility is just dripping off every word of that.
Unbelievable.
Beautiful reflection on her life and ours. There you go, right? So the levels on which that is dishonest is just extraordinary. But it doesn't, and it's been retweeted millions of times, and there are memes made of it, of, you know, all kinds of other photographs other than Kim Kardashian and her family on a beach. But she still gets that algorithm. She still gets those retweets. She still has traffic drawn to her Twitter account. That's how it works. It doesn't matter if people are going there in hate or distrust or loathing or contempt. It matters that they're going. And that is, to me, an insolvable problem. Because if you take that element out of social media, nobody's going to be interested in it. There's nothing else interesting about it. If you want actual conversation, if you want deep thought, you can read a magazine or listen to a podcast or go talk to your friends at a bar. You're not going to get deep thought on the internet. And yet the internet, social media, is controlling the way we have conversations outside of it. So even our real life conversations have begun to reflect the style of, I hate that, I love that, this person's a zero, they're canceled, this person's, oh my God, squad goals, I'm so like, I'm just, you know, I stand for so-and-so. These phrases that have come from the internet, those are used by algorithms to find you. If you're using them in real life, you've been brainwashed, kids.
But do you think that's why cancel culture, I mean, I was thinking about this, actually has a little, a little bit of merit, because we are at this place where the platforms aren't stopping it. And when something is ridiculous and dangerous and stupid, the algorithm pushes this kind of stuff forward. And so really the only tool that people inherently have is not so much to cancel, but to deplatform. Do you know what I'm saying?
I don't know. I do know what you're saying, but I think that that is to suggest that cancel culture, whatever the fuck that means, is a kind of, again, an objective standard. Who's canceling who? And what does being canceled mean? It means public shaming, right? It doesn't mean that you actually cease to exist. It means that you're shamed and you are then put into an algorithm where you have become, instead of a green light, you're a red light. So, you know, the tweets about Gian Gomeshi from 2009 and 2010 are 95% green light. And the tweets about Gian Gomeshi from 2014 and 15 are 95% red light. That doesn't solve anything. It doesn't indicate who Gian Gomeshi was all along. Right?
Right?
He was able to control that narrative one way, and then somebody else controlled the narrative another way. And it goes back to this thing that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago on the podcast that Zadie Smith was talking about, how people, you know, are saying, well, Pride and Prejudice, for example, should not be read anymore because it's a white supremacist colonialist book, because Mr. Darcy's a rich guy who made his money off slavery, and we shouldn't be romanticizing people like this. And Zadie Smith said, my daughter's reading Pride and Prejudice because it's one of my favorite books and it's a brilliant book. And when we get to the bit about Mr. Darcy being a very rich man, I say to her, how do you think Mr. Darcy might have earned that money? Well, the only way to make that kind of money back then was through the cotton trade or the sugar trade. So he was exploiting the white working class workers in Manchester who ran the mills that produced that stuff. And he was exploiting the black slaves in the Caribbean who ran the farms and the plantations that produced that stuff. Now let's read on. Let's complete history. Let's not erase one person and replace them with another false idol. Folks, enough of this. There are not heroes and zeros in this world. The binary of the internet is not reality. That is not how nature is made up of. There are not two colors in the rainbow. So it's to me, I don't think ultimately that the internet, which is the entire technology of computers, is based on the notion of the binary code. Once you realize that, and then you look at the fact that nature is based on fractals, if you look at it mathematically, it's impossible to reconcile the two. Nature is truth, and the internet is the lie. And that seems to be getting clearer and clearer and clearer by the day. Look at the virus. What is the truth of the virus? It's nature. It's a natural truth. You can quote quotes about how many people got sick wearing masks or how many people didn't get sick wearing masks or how many numbers of COVID-19 there are today versus yesterday. None of it means anything. The virus is nature, and this attempt to codify and to fit nature within our binary code that we are living in right now, this is the mistake, whether it's human beings or it's diseases or it's politics or anything else. And so to me, that's where art steps in. Because art cannot be put in the binary. And an attempt to do it, it just bleeds out all over the binary. And that's why it's a great interferer in between the kind of negative, positive reaction that goes on the internet. In between is art. In between is empathy. In between those two things is compassion and complexity and personal history and societal history and all these things that we have to look at and take into consideration if we are going to actually get past this moment. So I don't know, man. It's a tricky one.
Well, you know, the hypothesis of social media was that let everything come out and then the cream will rise to the top. The truth shall rise to the top.
Yeah.
But we're realizing that hypothesis was incorrect.
Didn't work.
It's just, that's just not how it rolls. I have a very like Thomas Hobbesian view of the world. I think human beings unchecked aren't going to love each other. They're going to destroy each other. That's just what I think. And I think we're like progressing towards being better. And this is why I'm a progressive. Because I believe that, you know, the human condition is not something that we need to return to, but I think it's something that we need to perfect, right? So we got to keep going.
Speaking of progressives, if you want to call him that, our prime minister this week, you know, I always like to call attention to the theater when it enters politics, because so much of politics is theater and so much of it is just fucking terrible theater, the worst possible theater I can possibly imagine. But this week, we have a little disagreement, I understand, Ali, because this week I think Justin Trudeau engaged in some pretty effective political theater and certainly gave me a little bit of what I was looking for from a politician. If you haven't seen this clip, Justin Trudeau gave a press conference on COVID-19 this week. Justin Trudeau, for those of you out there, who don't live in our country, is our prime minister. And he...
That's president. That's like a president.
That's like a president, yeah. He, with his sort of Leonard Cohen beard and his slightly kind of flaner, like, I don't give a fuck anymore, Plateau Montreal look that he's rocking, sat in front of a microphone and talked, I thought, pretty effectively and quite honestly about what it was like right now for all of us. And he said, this sucks. Those were the words he used. This really, really sucks. He talked about how his son, who's in grade one, asked him if COVID-19 was going to be here forever. And he began to tear up a little bit in that classic Justin Trudeau way that would have made him such a powerful person in the music industry if he'd chosen to pursue that. Because fake sincerity is how you sign bands, ladies and gentlemen. But I felt he meant it. And you know what? I watched it and I was like, thank you. I needed that from a politician. I needed an acknowledgement that this is really shitty right now. It's late October. I woke up this morning realizing that for the next 5 months, first world problems, but I will not be able to go see a movie. I will not be able to go get some food with friends. I will not be able to go to a Christmas party. There'll be nothing to do. There's going to be nothing to do for 5 months. I can't take my kid to the museum. I can't take her out skating even without worrying about it. Everything is, life's pleasures have been taken from us. We're in a kind of pleasant prison here in Canada. And his acknowledgement of that kind of made me feel a little better. Because I think that one of the things that is a bit of a balm is realizing every once in a while right now, everyone's in it. You know, everyone's projects have been canceled. Everyone is stir crazy. Everyone's life to some degree or other has been disrupted and taken away from them. And when you're in your own shit and you're waking up alone in your apartment every day, you forget that sometimes and you start to feel sorry for yourself. And it's easier to feel sorry for everybody, in my personal opinion, than it is to feel sorry for oneself. So I appreciated it, but you felt otherwise, I understand.
I don't fully disagree with you. I get it. I really appreciate the empathy. I appreciate, it felt like, you know, he's really understanding the depths and the difficulty of this. But what I was missing, and I'm starting to see it in just a lot of our leaders, is I'm missing the yes and. It sucks. And this is why we are doing it. And I want to remind you of the lives that are being saved, of the heroism that is occurring in your actions, that this is about a bigger thing than merely what's in front of you. Like, you know, we think about like the sacrifices that we are making right now, and they're profound, but we need positive reinforcement, you know, as people. We need to be reminded of what we are doing. And that is what I'm not seeing from our leaders. I'm seeing them saying, you know, this is really difficult. I get it. You know, COVID is unfair. It sucks. And that's really nice. But there's a part of me that's kind of missing the FDR, the Winston Churchill, the we will stand, you know, like at the end and we will do it. We need a little bit of like some galvanization. We need a little bit of inspiration. And empathy I could get for days.
Interesting.
You know?
Interesting, because this leads me to an article I wanted to point people towards. I put a link up on the Soft Revolution Twitter, but I'm not sure you can get through. It might be a paywall, but look for it. It's in the Boston Globe. And it's an article about how little art was made about the pandemic of 1918 and how little art probably will be made about this pandemic.
Yeah,
and
we spoke about that weeks ago. Like,
yeah, but
early
I think
on,
this
yeah.
links into to what you're talking about right now. Virginia Woolf wrote this, which I wanted to read because I thought it was so clever. English, she famously writes, this is from this Boston Globe article, which can express the thoughts of Hamlet and the tragedy of Lear, has no words for the shiver and the headache. And I thought, you know, yes, we do need some soaring rhetoric, but it's hard to do that when we're going through this experience that even as we go through it, we're trying to forget it, you know? And to me, that's why it's hard to make art about this as well. It's
hard to... How is it different than a war? Like, what is different about a war?
I'll tell you exactly what it is. Good question. I think that the difference is that it's so profoundly mundane and internal. Do you know what I mean? We can write about loneliness. We can write about fear. We can write about the dread of a bomb dropping on us. We can write about the comradeship. We can write about the tragedy of a battle. But these are, you know, these are kind of expressive outer experiences. And they're to some degree fear and dread. These things are universal. We all share them right now. But the experience of feeling ill and then feeling more ill, that's a private experience. You know, it's something everybody knows, but it's something that nobody wants to recall, right? It's why animals go out. It's why animals go off to die alone. It's an experience that you go through alone, and then once it's over, you want to forget it. So I think how do you as a politician express that without seeming like a bummer? It's tough.
Well, this goes into the notion of, you know, bringing art into politics and politics into art. You know, art's job is to turn the mundane into the magical, or to turn the thing that is death into life, you know? And I really think that if the right words were spoken, you know, in the beginning of this thing, and it's so funny, all the approval of so many people is going down now, right? Mm-hmm. It was so up in the beginning, and now mm-hmm. it's going down. And my hypothesis is that what people were projecting was the pride they had in themselves. They were putting it onto our leaders. Because what we're realizing is the glory of what occurred in March wasn't in our leaders. What were they doing? It was what we were doing. Mm-hmm. We were the heroes. And we need to be reminded again, now that we're going into what looks like, as Joe Biden says, a dark winter, which might be even darker than before. France is going into a lockdown. Germany's imposing a lockdown starting Monday. We need another push to remind people that this is for something. We are here to save lives, or we are here to prevent death, and that what we're doing, even though it sucks and is special, you know, we need yeah. that little
well,
sauce
in a
on
week,
top.
We're either going to have a bump of good cheer, or we're going to head right over the cliff and into the abyss. Because I think before we go to Carl, and we're going to talk about this a lot with him. But before we go to Carl, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention this is our last pod before Donald Trump goes or stays. And I don't know about you, but I am finding it very difficult to concentrate on anything. I'm finding it very difficult
yeah.
not to feel anxiety on a pretty much constant basis. And I actually have been thinking a lot this week and actually Googled the question, what am I going to do if Donald Trump wins again? And there's
what does your Google algorithm tell you?
There's not much. There has not been much written about it. I think people really don't know. I think people really don't know what they're going to do. I know that I have several friends in the United States. One of them's married to a Canadian, and they've started filling out their papers to come here. A couple of them are quite wealthy people and are making plans to escape. I think there is going to be cataclysm from a psychological perspective if Donald Trump wins this election. And I'm sorry to say that I think he's got a very good chance indeed. And I think that as artists, we need to begin to consider what it means for us in the long term. Because the United States, unfortunately, is a massive part of any artist's market who works in English, right? So whether you're a writer, a musician, an actor, whatever you are affected by the U.S. economy and by the cultural state of the United States. And I think that we need to recognize that things may be very, very different for all of us in a week and start to try and figure out what that means, you know? And to me, I guess, what that means is that art, let me say it this way. I think you don't know how things will be, right? When a trauma first strikes, you were talking about March and how noble we all were in doing that together. And I think that's a beautiful point, well made. And I haven't thought about this enough. But at this point, I'm becoming much more deeply aware of the long-term consequences of this pandemic that I didn't account for in March. Even though I thought I was thinking of all the eventual outcomes, I wasn't, you know? And I guess I think all artists out there have to reckon with this truth that these ripples are spreading and spreading faster than we can keep up with them. And that when we come back, when theater comes back, when music comes back, if we ever do, we are really, really seriously, guys, going to have to start from nothing and make an argument for our existence that we haven't even begun to think about. And I'm sorry to say that argument will not come through social media, and it won't come through identity politics, and it won't come through wokeness, and it won't come through, you know, kicking over an establishment that no longer exists. It's going to come from the work we do, from the stories we tell, the music we make, the books we write, the paintings we paint, the beauty of what we do. And so I guess for me as an artist, I'm trying to lose my political self as much as I can right now and return to some kind of original notion about why I'm doing this and become a universal thinker instead of one predicated on my identity and my politics and all those things that take up so much space in the modern dialogue. So I don't know if you have anything to add to that, Ali, but I think that's sort of a great place to begin our conversation with Carl, because I think this has been on Carl's mind a lot, and he's got a lot to say about it.
Definitely. One thing I do want to add is that I read this amazing thing in New York Magazine, and it talked about, the title is If Trump Wins, mm-hmm. Athletes Might Just Stop Playing. And you thought what we saw in a couple months ago with the NBA and the NHL was tough. Just wait. If Trump somehow throws this into the courts and tries to make it a thing, professional sports might just stop. So there still will be a protest. Yeah, let's definitely go to Carl, but I just want a lot of people to know this is our last show before the election. And I'm like a big political junkie. I'm just going to give you some tips on what you need to look for on Tuesday night. We might not get all the votes in just because the ballots are being mailed in a historic fashion, but there are three states I want you to look at and three states that will have their results that night. That is Florida, Ohio, North Carolina. If Donald Trump loses any of those states, it is over. There is nothing he can do. He has no path. And the state that I'm looking at the most is North Carolina. And the reason I'm looking at it is because on the ballot in North Carolina is a Medicaid expansion. One of the things of Obamacare was that it expanded Medicaid, which is what you give to poor people, right? Healthcare for poor people. And that is on the ballot. If the legislature gets flipped to Democrats, people get healthcare. So watch those three states, Florida, Ohio, North Carolina. Next week, we've got Jen Lena here. Hopefully, we're going to be talking about a Trump loss. My gut is telling me that it's going to be a landslide on Tuesday. I hope I'm right. I think this
right
is going
too,
to
buddy.
Be a disaster
hope,
for Trump.
I hope more than I have ever hoped for anything
yeah.
that you are right. But
yeah.
I don't know, man. I got a bad feeling in my bones, but you know me.
There's tequila either way is the way I'm playing it.
That could just be my bones. They're bad bones. They've been bad since the beginning. We're lucky to have our next guest on. Carl Newman's a member of the New Pornographer, is one of the great Canadian bands of the last 20 years. Actually, one of those bands that for me as a musician constantly made me want to work harder. They always put records out that make me think, God damn, why didn't I write that song? So it's a real honor to have him. And we're going to talk to him right now about life in the States as a Canadian, life in the world as an artist, and what he's going to do next. Carl Newman on Soft Revolution.
I mean, in a lot of ways, things haven't changed for me because I used to spend a lot of time at home just piddling, you know, on working on demos, and now I'm just doing that more.
Yeah, me too. Free work.
And sometimes, you know, and sometimes I forget what's going on in the rest of the world because, you know, we have our little house on a few acres here and, you know, and it's me and my wife and my son. And sometimes you forget that, oh, right, when we go out, we have to wear a mask because, you know, sometimes I don't leave this place for a couple days. Yeah. But it was, I was going to say, like, the shows didn't feel that weird to play, but the weirdest thing was, for me, was there was a third person playing, my friend Zach Janikian, who I know here from Woodstock, and he's an amazing musician, and we rehearsed at his place. So there was a point where me and Zach were running through the songs before Nico showed up, and I was just sitting at his kitchen table with his husband, and we were just sitting around drinking red wine, and it felt so weird. And I thought, good God, it's been like a year since I've just sat around a table with my friends and just talked. I mean, it just made me glad I was doing it again. You know, I feel like a lot of people, our pods are getting a little bigger.
So tell us where you live. You live in Woodstock, is that right? I mean, I don't want to dox you or anything, but you live in the Woodstock area. So you've been there for how long now? Because you're from Vancouver, obviously. How long have you been in the States?
11 years in Woodstock and about 15, a little over 15 years in America.
So a lot of that time was spent in Obama's America, and upstate New York, as you say, is so bucolic and beautiful. And there's a really great little artistic community up around Woodstock and it's cheap to buy a nice place up there. You can afford a lot of land.
It's not cheap. It's just cheaper.
Yeah. Cheaper than New York. Yeah.
Cheaper than Vancouver or Toronto.
Vancouver. Yeah. Everything's cheaper than Vancouver. But yeah, so you've been there for 11 years and your kid's American.
Yeah, half Canadian though.
But in 4 days, you know, Donald Trump, there is a chance, although Ali thinks it's slim to none, there is a chance that Donald Trump could win again and the United States could enter like a very, very terrifying period of time. Have you thought, are you looking at next Tuesday and being like, worst case scenario, I'm getting in the car and getting the fuck out of here?
You know, my wife, who's American, is the number one person who's like, let's get the hell out of here. You know, and she wants to go to Vancouver. I want to go to Montreal, but she doesn't like the fact that she wouldn't be able to work because she doesn't speak French. And I think, well, fair enough.
Yeah.
But knowing that I'm kind of hesitant to go back to Vancouver because it's so expensive and it almost makes me feel like a failure. I couldn't make it. I couldn't make it in America. I had to come back here.
So do you feel like an American? I mean, do you identify that way now?
I do because everything that happens in America affects me so much. Like, it affects my son. It affects my wife. Like, I'm here. And sometimes I have to remember that, when I'm talking about America, I talk about America as us and we. Mm-hmm. And I realize, well, that is true. And it's also not true. And that I can leave if I want. And a lot of people, every time I bring up on Twitter, why am I still here? You know, there's 100 people going, good question. Why are you still here?
And what's the answer?
Well, because this is my home, you know, and this is the house where my son was born. And I think there's something really depressing about being forced out of your home. You know, like like whether it's money or politics. And here in America, it's both, you know, like I did the math and I figured it out that if we moved to Vancouver and rented a place that was $5,000 a month, it would still be less expensive than it is to live here.
Because of healthcare? Am I right to assume it's because of like stuff like that you have to pay for?
Yeah. And, you know, the schools aren't that good here. So our son's in a local private school, which is a pretty cheap private school, but still, you know, it's still something to pay for. I mean, cause we're in an area that as liberal as it is here in Woodstock, it's very close to Trump country. If our son went to fourth grade at the local elementary school, like he would be in full on in Trump country. We'd have to drive like 15 or 20 minutes and we'd be in a different world.
What's that like as an artist? Like living in the States right now, obviously you have your bubble of people who, you know, probably feel the way about the world that you do as artists, but mm-hmm. you're also in a community, as you say, that's like very split. There's a very, you know, old school white working class rednecky aspect to upstate New York. And then there's a lot of artists who've moved up there because it's a place you can find space and have a jam space, et cetera. Can you feel that tension? Like what's that like to have in your life? Or are you all able to find a sense of community together?
No, our community is full on liberal artist musician types.
Right.
Like there are enough of them here. Like I know more musicians here than I ever did in Vancouver. like every instrument I could ever need to on a record. Like I know who to call, you know? So Woodstock's it's pretty amazing that way. I mean, of course you know some people that are technically outside of your bubble, and those are the people that you try not to talk to about politics.
You and I are kind of in the same situation in our lives in that we are in bands where everybody is all over the place and we've been together a really long time and everybody has like a side hustle they do and things they do out of the band, but the band still remains our main source of income and kind of the center of our career. It's strange that stars and new pornos do have this very similar trajectory, even in terms of how long we've been around and stuff.
Although for people like Nico and, you know, and then Behar, when he was, you know, with us, it was like, we were always like the side project, you know? I've been saying that to people for years. Like it's weird that my main project is technically a side project.
Now you find yourself in this new situation where flying around, there's quarantines, you know, Behar and John and a bunch of people in your band who are involved with the making of those records are still in Vancouver. I know there's also folks who are in the prairies, I think. So what is the plan? Like when you look at the next year of your life in terms of new pornos, is there a way you guys are going to get together, or have you kind of resolved to just not doing it?
I don't know. You know, well, we're technically working on a record. Our drummer has family in New Hampshire, so he was here like at the end of July, and I said, "Why don't you just come here and do some drums? Like you're here, right. You know, like yeah. like let's like I wasn't planning on having you, but you know, I had a ton of demos I was working on, and then I thought I don't even know where these demos are going or who they're for, but you might as well come and drum on all of them." And, you know, and he was up for that. And Catherine has a studio in her house, you know, because, you know, she's married to Colin Stewart and they have a functioning studio in their house.
Right.
So it's very easy for me to send her songs and her to send back like, you know, 12 studio quality keyboard tracks. So that works really well. That was a great realization when I realized that I didn't have to be standing behind her when she worked, you know, like she could just do it and send it to me. And if I wanted to change it, I could call her and she could send me the changed version an hour later. So, the weird part is that John lives on one of the islands off Vancouver Island now, because he took his girlfriend and his child and they left Seattle and they just went to the island, you know, the minute COVID started rearing its ugly head.
Yeah, I know a few people who've done that, actually.
Yeah, so he barely has internet. Like last time I talked to him, he said, "Hey, can you mail me a thumb drive?" And I was like, what year is it, man?
When this began, I'm sure you had plans for the year, as we all did, and I'm sure they all disappeared. Mm-hmm. You find yourself now where you're at. Are you, where's your state of mind? Where do you find yourself in terms of your sense of what your life as an artist is right now? If that's not too big a question.
You know, I don't know. I went through waves, and I'm going through waves of just being excited about working on new music, mm-hmm. but then kind of hitting a wall because I'm mostly by myself. And you can go crazy. You know, you get to a point where you're listening to stuff that might basically be done, but you're like, what else can I do to it? And you know, there was a point where I thought to myself, what have I done in the last 2 weeks? Like, I've been working on music for 2 weeks, but I don't feel like I'm any further along. So I've taken breaks and just said, like, screw it. And then I come back a month later and I feel good about it. And I've been doing stuff with Nico, which is good. I mean, the irony of this whole thing is Nico and I are actually closer together than we've ever been in like 20 years. Mm-hmm. Because she lives 4 hours from me, which is not that far. And it's, you know, so when I want her to come in here and record, she'll drive here and I drove there, and you know, and I can work with her on music. So
I think that's a really cool point to make, because it's something I've found too, and I encourage others out there to do this. Like, because everyone's at home, there are friends who aren't working as much as they used to, or aren't as busy as they used to be. And suddenly you have the opportunity, the time to kind of, even if it's over the internet, to reach out and collaborate creatively on something, even whether it's writing music or writing a script or whatever it is, you can, or doing a podcast like Ali and I have done. We haven't seen each other since this whole thing began. This has just been something we do sitting in our living rooms. Mm-hmm. And it's been a really great thing to go and find friends who I've always been close to but haven't made art with in a long time, or have never made art with, and have that time to do it with them, you know? But as you say, I was running yesterday and I thought to myself, I was counting, I was like, holy shit, I've written 2 albums worth of songs and a musical this year. And like, what's going to happen? Yeah, but what's going to happen? Like, and then what? You know what I mean? Like, we're at this point, I've been writing this musical with a couple of pals, and now we need to workshop it to know whether it works or not, but we can't workshop it. Like, what will become of it? It's this strange thing of having made art in a paradigm and in a context that I was used to. It's like, make the art, record the art, tour the art, or find a theater to put it out. That's all an unknown. So then I ask myself, and I don't know whether you have or not, but I certainly have, and I know Ali has. Maybe you can speak to this a little bit, Ali, because you're an actor, which you had a 3-year, 8 fucking show a week gig. But for me, it's like my biggest anxiety, aside from COVID dreams, like I seem to be dreaming every night that my family gets sick with COVID now, that which is really fun. But my biggest anxiety—
Don't make that into a musical is what I would suggest.
COVID! Yeah. Exclamation point.
It's probably already been done.
Is probably being worked on. My biggest sort of anxiety point is in my sense of identity. Like, who am I? Do you ask yourself that question?
I feel like I've asked myself that many times. I think it's unhealthy to put too much of your identity into what you do, you know? Like, I think that's when you get to a point where if somebody insults your record and you take it as an insult of you as a person, as an insult to your entire life, to your entire being, I don't think that's healthy. But yet I feel that way. And as much as I can talk about not wanting to feel that way, I think I do put a ton of my identity in there. There are points where during this, I feel like it would be so nice to just not have to worry. Like, sometimes I settle in like, yeah, I'm cool with just not doing much. It's like, I don't need the adulation of fans. You know, I like making music, but you know, like I just think I just like to have some sort of security. And I say that as a person who is like more secure financially than probably like 90% of the population, you know? But that part, you know, it's, I try not to think about it too much, but it's kind of unnerving.
I kind of find, you know, COVID, I don't know if you guys feel it, like COVID's like this accelerant, you know, like 2030 is 2020. Like it's just pushed everything that was coming towards us. And, you know, it kind of feels like for me, like I'm doing things that were always in kind of like the back of my head or sitting in like my back pocket that I didn't know if I wanted to touch, or, and I was just waiting for the right moment. And then it was like all those things that were like unspoken inside of me are speaking now.
I think I'm just continuing, you know,
right.
Just trying to make music, but it has affected the way I do it because like it's impossible not to think about the world, what I'm writing about, or what I'm trying to write about. Like it's made me ask myself like what does an artist need to be literally political right now? Uh-huh. You know, uh-huh. I start thinking about like, what if I was a classical musician, or what if I was Explosions in the Sky? You know, like they make their music and it doesn't have to address politics. You know what right. I mean?
Yeah.
But I feel like, am I being dishonest by writing music that don't address politics? And I look through my notebooks of like lyrics I was trying to write from like 4 or 5 months ago, and they seem artlessly angry and political. And I look at them and I was like, well, it was honestly what I felt, but I don't want to put that into a song because I don't think I'm not Run the Jewels. I don't think, you know, I don't think it would come off in the right way coming from me.
It's difficult that's fascinating what you're talking about, because I often get into this conversation with myself, and we were talking to Tegan Quinn last week about this, because, you know, mm-hmm. they're so overtly political in the way they run their business, and they're very outspoken and great advocates for all kinds of things. What Tegan said, which I think resonated for me, was you can be, the act of being a band is a political act. And the way that you present yourself and the things you care about and the things you talk about and the way you use your platform is what actually matters politically.
I've thought of that too. Or just the act of being a band that has women and men playing together,
right?
You know, is a political statement.
It is, yeah.
You know, for sure. It's like, for sure. But that's not to put down the bands that are five dudes. It's like, yeah, that just. That's
they
the,
just
that's
suck
the way
a little bit more. That's
yeah.
They're just not quite as good. We're not trying to put them down. It's just that they're not as good.
they're just not as, what's the word for it? I don't want to be insulting. Not as elevated. They're not as elevated. They're not as empathetic.
Well, yeah, the way I always thought about that was the reason I wanted to have two voices in Stars was because you get two sides to the story, right? It's like there are no stories that anybody has that couldn't be told a different way. And there's so many songs that are told from the perspective of one person or another.
For me, I think I've always liked the idea of like getting out of myself or getting away mm-hmm. from myself. Like, mm-hmm. like I've always wanted to play music, and sure, I like the idea of being a rock star, but I never saw myself as like, you know, I'm not the person who gets on stage and just feeds off the audience. You know, right. I'm not like, oh, I want to be a front man. You know, it was kind of thrust upon me. Like I wanted to write songs, and so I guess I need to be the singer. You know, it was all thrust upon me. So when the Pornographers came together, I thought, you know, I like the idea of like, I thought Dan had good songs, and I thought, well, we can both write songs and we can both be singers. And, you know, and I knew Nico, and I thought, and you can be a singer. And I thought it just deflected some of the attention away. You know, I really like the idea of a band, but then even within a band, there's the irony of it is that you try and start a faceless band and you can't stop.
Yeah.
You can't stop people from breaking off and becoming the stars or the center or what, you know?
You know, you're in this country that's facing fascism down, and you could leave, and it's your home, and you're trying to make art. So is that like a profound change for you? Or do you look at yourself now as like, I am obligated to speak my politics? Or is that something that you can separate from your art? Can the two be separated anymore for you?
Well, I think I've decided to separate them. I mean, I think anybody who follows me online at all knows my politics. Mm-hmm. You know, like I think I pretty much yell it every day for an hour or two. So, I think I've just been, and I think it's so much of the music that I love. Like I think of the first few Eno records. You know, Eno was just writing word salad. You know. Mm-hmm. Like he was just making this perfect sounding word salad, and what he was trying to do that was interesting was his approach to music. It wasn't what he was trying to say. And I also like that Eno has talked about how like the song is a piece. Like, you know, like you shouldn't separate the lyrics. Like the lyrics and the music should be connected. You know, they shouldn't be separate. Mm-hmm. And I think. Like I always think of like, you know, like communications theory, like that I studied at SFU, you know, like Marshall McLuhan about all the, you know, the medium is the message or the medium is the massage. I just like the idea of like just putting the song out there, and it's just self-explanatory. And often, yeah, I'm writing songs about songs, and it's kind of circular, right. But I think why not, you know? I can do, you know, sometimes I wish I had the guts to write something like Blank Frank, you know?
Right.
I would never show up in the band room and go, this is my new song. It's called Trick Nick. You know, I just say, I just say Trick Nick. And then I like say a bunch of other shit, and that's the song. And I love it.
Smells like a hit to me.
But you know, like I love it when Eno does that, but I think, oh, is it my place to do that?
Right.
And I think, you know, well, why not? Because that comes back to like, you know, wanting to get out of my head. When I make songs like that, I'm telling myself, but this is just gibberish, you know, and that makes me feel like, I'm false in some way. But then I realize, no, you shouldn't think of the world like that. You know, it's just music, and it can be its own thing.
Carl Newman on the Soft Revolution podcast. Thank you so much, Carl, for joining us from upstate New York. Sounds pretty heavenly where he is, actually.
Yeah, you see that bird?
Yeah.
Like, and it was great. I love that. I get none of that here.
No, you get no birds, except if they fly into your window on the 20th floor. That's it for another pod. I just want to point out that I thought there were some really good lessons in what Carl was saying. Basically, like, you have to let the work take care of you right now. And I'm trying to remember that myself, that the results have been taken away from us and all we have left is the process. And that can be hard on the ego, and it can be hard on your sense of what it all means or whether it's worth it. But, you know, it really is like the more beauty you make, the more beautiful you'll feel. So, mm-hmm. I think that's something, you know, that I'm learning more and more. It's like, I do have to work as hard as it is when there's no one to watch it or listen to it. It's almost more important to do it now. Do you know what I mean? Yeah,
for sure, man.
It's like, you can't just pray when people are watching. You got to pray when people aren't watching as well. And so I'm going to go try and make some fucking art after this. That's Soft Revolution for another week. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to Carl Newman. Go and buy Carl's records. They're all phenomenal. You really can't go wrong. He's one of the great songwriters in the world, not just in Canada, but in the world. And we appreciate him being here. Please get back to us. Let us know your thoughts, your feelings, your fears, your fantasies, your dreams, your doubts at Soft Revcast on Instagram, on Twitter. Email us at softrevcast@gmail.com. And please go to our Patreon, where you can hear Carl Newman answer some of the Proust questionnaire. You can hear Daniel Handler, Tegan Quinn. Who else have we done it with? We've done it with a bunch of awesome people. And next week, we will be broadcasting from a different world, people.
Hopefully.
Whether it's different in that it's better or it's different in that it is much, 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 much worse, we're still going to be here. And we're going to have Jennifer Lena with us. Jennifer is a friend of the pod and a dear friend of ours and one of the great thinkers about the relationship between culture and politics right now in the United States. And I know that no matter what the result is, Jennifer will give us something to think about. So please join us next week for Jennifer Lena and our post-election coverage. It will either be extremely celebratory and kind of hopeful, or it will feature me being talked off a ledge by Ali Moman. Either way, it'll be worth listening to. Ali, what's your art pick this week?
My art pick, first of all, I did see Borat. I actually laughed my ass off. This guy good. Is unbelievable. And I got to say, he one interesting thing about Borat is that, you know, there's the character of the daycare, the woman who runs the daycare, and she's this black woman, and she's like the soul of that movie, and she's so sensible, and she's just like, doesn't take anyone's shit. And I'm going to say something about black women, okay? There's only one demographic in America that over 90%, regardless of age, regardless of income, regardless of education, are going to be voting for Joe Biden. That is black women. Thank you, black women of America. I trust you. I love you. My art pick, actually, Carl mentioned AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, in his Proust questionnaire. She is an incredible, incredible person. And she is my art pick. My sister in New York sent me an Instagram live of hers. It's a video trying to get people to go out and vote. It's her just talking to the camera underneath some music that her and her people made. This woman, she could have made Oscars. Instead, she has decided to become a politician, and she's decided to change the world.
I think she can change the world. I really believe she's going to be Abraham Lincoln level president. I really do.
She's
incredible human being, and she kind of is getting. She's stepping up to it. You know, she seems to have the fierceness and the moral center to withstand the amount of publicity and the amount of abuse she's taking, and get better at it. It's pretty incredible. Yep. Awesome. Yep. Well, send me the link to that and maybe put it up on our Twitter and on our Instagram
Sure.
So folks can watch it. My art pick this week, I'm, you know, fuck you. You get a podcast. If you want to toot your own horn, get a podcast. That's what I did. And that's what I'm going to do. I've been making music with this friend of mine, Chris Dumont, for like, 25, 30 years. We've been writing songs together. And we have a project called Memphis, which is just us. And every, you know, 5 or 6 years we get together and we spend some summers together and we try and make some music. And during the quarantine, Chris, after not making music with him for a long time, he sent me this piece of music. And it was actually the first thing I wrote in quarantine. It's a song called Desire. And it makes me sad to listen to because I feel like it really captured the very beginnings of how scary this thing was in a sense of lost time and a questioning of whether things will ever be not the same again, but feel safe again. And we put the song out. We just decided we were going to put it out. So it's up on Apple Music and Spotify and all that garbage. If you want to go find it, the name of our band is Memphis and the song is called Desire. I'm very good at coming up with titles for things that are impossible to Google. But if you just Google
your
Memphis.
Your SEO sucks. Your search engine
SEO,
optimization.
Yes. I am a bad SEOer.
Just write a song called SEO. See what happens.
Maybe we'll put a link up or something on the on the Twitter account for you. But we'll play you a little bit of it now. A shameless plug for my own music. This is Memphis with Desire. That was Soft Revolution for another week. Thanks for listening. Love you, Ali.
Love you too, bro.
You press play and a week goes by and all the changes is the sky. And the light that moves through the living room and the things you hoped would be. All the days are the same. Dawn is sunshine, dusk and rain. Knock 3 times on the kitchen door. Then don't come round here no more. I told you before. Again, will it ever be the same? Our faces covered and our hearts on fire. That's no way to read desire. Desire will win the day. Desire will end this fray. Desire. desire in every way. Desire is what makes me stay.
It's what makes me stay.